Now, in an earlier lecture I gave, which you may also have, on Buddhism, I indicated that what I was putting across in that lecture were the basics of Buddhism, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence, and so on. But I pointed out that you cannot generalize about Buddhism because for the last, going on for 2,000 years at any rate, it has divided into two quite definite streams. A little bit like Christianity, I suppose, with its Roman Catholicism and its Protestantism. The two streams are known, and the best way to do it is to spell these words, the Theravada stream and the Mahayana. The Theravada is spelt Theravada, and Mahayana is Mahayana, Mahayana. Theravada literally means the tradition or teachings of the elders. Earlier, it was known as the Hinayana, Hinayana, tradition, which contrasts quite nicely with Mahayana. The two quite literally mean, Hinayana means lesser vehicle or lesser school, if you like, or a narrower path. And the Mahayana, Maha always means large or great, means the greater vehicle, the greater, the wider path. Now, the Hinayana school originally had a number of schools, all but one of which have ceased to be, and the only one that remains is the Theravada school. And since, therefore, Hinayana has only one school, Theravada, and since the name Tradition of the Elders has a little bit more of a ring to it than narrow vehicle, it is Theravada by which this stream is known. Well, now, what are the main differences between these two? Basically, you could say that the Theravada tradition insists that the only teaching that can be validly described as Buddhist teaching is that which goes right back to the time of Buddha himself, living in the 6th, a little bit of the 5th centuries BCE. In other words, you could say they are the conservatives. The Mahayana school, on the other hand, accepts the fact that times change, that ideas which applied perhaps hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, have changed as well, and that it is a natural thing that a point of view expressed quite comprehensively at a certain time may have to modify some of its ideas for the benefit of all as time goes by. And in addition, the Theravada school has persisted in countries near to India in Southeast Asia. In other words, they are the ones that are in the countries nearest to the country which Buddha was born in and where Buddhism first developed. It has now left India, which is rather interesting, but it did settle in the Southeast Asia peninsula. That is to say, such countries as Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka. And in those countries, supremely, the Theravada tradition is maintained. In fact, in some of those countries, every young man at the age of when he would normally in other countries perhaps be called up for military service has to do 2 years as a monk. Which is rather, I think, interesting. I suppose if you're going to call somebody up for 2 years' service on the part of his country, better to do it as a monk than as a warrior. Well, that's a point of view which represents a value judgment of my own. The Mahayana tradition has grown as Buddhism spread further afield. And there are major parts of the world which have embraced Buddhism, in China and Japan, and, of course, particularly in Tibet. And then in the Western world, Buddhism has become quite a prominent feature in the religions of the West. Most towns will have quite a number of Buddhist communities. And in the process of doing this, it's naturally encountered native ideas and native religious traditions. And inevitably, as Buddhism has settled into this new culture, some of the ideas from the original culture have mingled with Buddhism, so that you've got what can be described as a mixture rather than a watering down of the ideas. And a typical example of that is Tibetan Buddhism. If you're talking about Tibetan Buddhism, you must put the word Tibetan in front to indicate what kind of Buddhism you're talking about. Well, let's just see, before I look at two of these Mahayana schools, just what the, when it came down to it, what the differences are between Theravada and Mahayana. For a start, those who followed the Theravada tradition argued that only the original writings of Buddha could be accepted. Now, Buddha spoke, and he and his followers, that is to say, those who were immediately around him, encircling him, wrote in a dialect of Sanskrit, which is known as Pali, P-A-L-I. And there are three major works known to all Buddhists as the Tripitaka. I won't spell that because its meaning is quite clear when you translate it. The Three Baskets. These three major works are in Pali, and they're known as the Pali Canon. That is to say, they accepted as authoritative because they are in Pali. And only those works are seen as being really totally acceptable. In the Mahayana tradition, other teachers of Buddhism, centuries after Buddha lived and died, have given their own ideas. One in particular is a very famous one, Nagarjuna, who taught 700 or 800 years after Buddha. The Theravada people will not say these works are useless, but what they say is that the only authoritative works for knowing what Buddha actually said, and therefore what Buddhism stands for, and therefore how they should be living their lives today, are those that are in the Tripitaka, the Three Baskets. So that was the first thing, and it is rather basic, because it does mean excluding quite a lot of writing that emerged in the ensuing centuries. Secondly, there was a difference of opinion about who Buddha actually was. Now, there are people who will describe Buddha as the Lord Buddha. But these people belong in the Mahayana tradition. It's probably the phrase you will hear quite often in Western Buddhist meetings, the Lord Buddha. And you will see images of the Buddha, usually quite corpulent, not to say fat, but always looking very happy. There are slender images of Buddha as well, but you will see these images. Now, these represent or are reflective of the Mahayana tradition. Because in that tradition, the concept is that in some spiritual way, Buddha, his person, is still available to us. And I suppose in a way you could say that this is not dissimilar to the way some Christians, at any rate, perhaps most Christians, speak of Jesus as still alive in our midst and still here to guide us and all the rest. And there are many Buddhists who feel the same about Buddha. Now, the Theravada tradition completely rejects this. In that tradition, the argument is that Buddha is a supreme example, a teacher with words of deep wisdom, and one whose style of life we can, if we so choose, follow and imitate, But as a being, he is no longer available to us. The idea that we can speak to Buddha today would be alien to Theravada thinking. He is a great teacher, great prophet, but there have been other great teachers as well, of course. But he is, all right, he's the most important of them all. But that is it. Buddha is dead and gone. Now you might say, well, if he's dead and gone, what about Nirvana? Well, this is a very difficult word, and it's very difficult to know what Buddha meant by Nirvana. He certainly said that to enter Nirvana was the gateway to eternity, and that anybody who had entered Nirvana had reached the end of his path, or the path he was here to follow during this life. Not that he said many would in any one lifetime, but those who had reached their goal. But there's a lot of debate as to what Nirvana actually means. I mean, literally, it means blowing out as of a candle. Now, what exactly is it that's blown out? See, Buddha said that one of the marks of existence was an Atman, no soul, no self. So if you haven't got a self which is immortal, what then survives after death? If you're blown out, what survives? Now, the Mahayana tradition, I think, ignores this particular issue, or waters it down somewhat. In the Mahayana tradition, as I say, Buddha is still available, so he's certainly not blown out, even though he is in Nirvana. And I suspect that really it's become rather like the idea of eternal bliss in heaven, which you get in the theistic religions, that it is a continuing with improvements of the consciousness that we have in this existence. But that is not the original teaching of Buddha. And the debate between Buddhists is pretty strong on this. Buddha himself was extremely reticent about this particular issue. He said to all those who asked him, what is Nirvana? He said, you will know when you enter it. And that's all he was prepared to say. Probably wisely, because it's very difficult to describe any kind of spiritual experience to somebody else. But of course, we're still up against this literal meaning of Nirvana, blowing out. Some would say it means the blowing out of bad karma, so that we're now in a state of perfection. But that too is a debatable point. I think one could fairly say that Buddha is arguing that at the end of this life, having experienced Nirvana, you no longer have to come back again, be reborn, to follow through the travails and tribulations of a world which, as he says, as the first of the marks of existence, is dominated by dukkha, suffering, frustration, unfulfillment. So there's that one, the person of Buddha. And this, the next issue on which they disagreed, was on what the ideal follower of Buddha is supposed to be. And here we've got two different words, and I'll have to spell them both to you. The ideal, the person who has reached his goal in the Theravada tradition, is the arahat, or arhat. I'll give it its longer spelling, A-R-A-H-A-T. Now, what is the arahat? The arahat is one who, one assumes, is now at the end of a road that began many lives or many cycles of experience earlier. But in this life, he is one who has entered into Nirvana and therefore no longer returns, no longer has to return. Whatever Nirvana is, that's where the arahat is. And like Buddha, the arahat is not available to us. We can read of his life. We can take inspiration from his life. If he's done any writing, we can take inspiration from his teaching. But he himself is either enjoying or otherwise eternity. In the words of one writer of about Buddhism, Ingrid Fischer Schreiber, she says this of the Arahat: he is fully free of the 10 fetters, that is, chains, of the cycle of existence, namely, belief in an individual entity, skepticism, clinging to rights and rules, sensual desire, resentment, craving for refined corporeality and non-corporeality, that is to say, wanting things for your body and wanting possessions, grasping after things, arrogance, excitement, and ignorance. And then she says this: an arhat is seen as a person all of whose impurities are dissolved, whose wishes are fulfilled, who has laid down his burden, attained his goal, and freed his mind through perfect understanding. But nothing added as to what state the arahat is in present engaged in. Now, you'll note, incidentally, the male pronoun that I'm using there. So far, and it's really, this is quite significant, it's not just accidental that the male pronoun is used, because in the Theravada tradition, only monks can enter into nirvana in this cycle of existence, and only males can become monks. There are women Buddhists in that tradition, of course there are. But the best that a female Buddhist in the Theravada tradition can look to in this life is to so live and build up such karma that in the next cycle of experience, she will be born as a male. And having been born as a male, it is then his decision whether to become a monk, because you cannot enter nirvana unless you become a monk. That is the Theravada, very strict tradition. A lot of people think this is rather against the whole idea of Buddhism, but Buddha himself said that he did not wish to have women in the monasteries because he felt that would just cause chaos and confusion. There are those who say that towards the end of his life, Buddha was rather apologetic for this and felt that he should rethink that one. But this is a lot of debate as to whether he did change his mind on that issue. The fact is that in the Theravada tradition, women will have to wait if they want to achieve nirvana. So that is the Theravada, the arhat who has followed his spiritual path and is now, whatever he is enjoying, is doing so on his own. In the Mahayana tradition, there is a very different image indeed. The ideal in the Mahayana tradition is the Bodhisattva. I better spell that. B-O-D-D-H-I. That is equivalent to Buddha and means enlightened one. That's what Buddha means, the enlightened one. So body is enlightened. B-O-D-D-H-I. And then Sattva. S-A-T-T-V-A. The Bodhisattva. Now, the Bodhisattva is one who has followed the same kind of path as the Arahat, has attained nirvana. But unlike the Arahat, who has proceeded into the state of nirvana and has left the world to carry on making out its own way, working out its own salvation, Buddha's last words, work out your own salvation. Instead of that, it is taught that the Bodhisattva has remained available to anyone who calls upon him or her, and there are female Bodhisattvas, in their need. They are here to encourage, to strengthen, to counsel, and so on. Others who are trying to follow the same path and are further back.
I think we can see a parallel between the bodhisattvas and the saints in Christianity, particularly in the Roman Catholic form of Christianity. People feel that the saints are around, the saints have achieved heaven, but instead of going into heaven and enjoying it on their own, they too are still around in a spiritual sense and still available to help us. And people will be without embarrassment when they pray to their own patron saint or their own particular saint and see them as guardians and guides, helpers in distress and so on. And you will see images of the various saints wherever you go in Catholic countries. And you'll find Catholics there praying before these images. Well, this is the same kind of point of view. And the Bodhisattva is around to help. So we've immediately seen a distinction that the Theravada tradition is saying, you've got to work this out for yourself, and it's only you. You can take advice, but in the end, it's up to you, the path you tread. I see a link with existentialism there, incidentally. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, one is assisted by those who have gone before. And this brings another point forward. That in the Theravada tradition, that idea that if you're going to make progress, it must be by your own choices, your own decisions, by your own efforts, that you will do so. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, and in one of them, which I'm going to look at in a moment, the Pure Land tradition in China, very strongly this is emphasized, the merit, the virtue which has been won by the Bodhisattva, can, if the follower is deeply committed to the way and believes in the Bodhisattva and expresses that belief, then the merit that that Bodhisattva has gained can be transferred, or some of it can be transferred, to somebody else that is following along the way. So that the path is partly by their own efforts. That's not eliminated. But also they can be strengthened and, as it were, given a good boost along the path by the merits that are transferred to them from the Bodhisattva. It's almost like the idea of Christianity, that we can't achieve heaven or salvation on our own, but by the grace or the merit that comes to us through, in this case, Jesus Christ, though others might say through some of the saints, we are given a bit of a boost. Now, the Theravada tradition would see that, quite frankly, as offensive. They would argue that if we haven't been able to do it ourselves, then we haven't been able to do it. And they're quite rigid on that particular point. Just one or two other differences between them. Rites and rules were two of the things from which the arhat was released, two of the fetters. And in the Theravada tradition, the main activity, both in private and in public, is meditation. You will be expected as a Theravada Buddhist to spend a good deal of time in that activity. And if you are a monk, of course, you will spend a very large amount of your time in that way. In the Bodhisattva tradition, various forms of ritual and liturgy have been developed. And if you go to a meeting in the West, you'll probably find that there'll be chanting and discussion, and there'll be quite an imposing-looking shrine built up with imagery to enable you to understand the teaching that it is all representative of. So in the Theravada tradition, a downplaying of ritual, and when we come on to talk about Zen, we'll see that this is really totally downplayed. The other thing is that in the Theravada tradition, you don't get the sense of concern about the needy people in society that you find in the Mahayana tradition. Since the Bodhisattva is one who has voluntarily stood back from entering into the final bliss of nirvana because he or she wishes to help those further back along the way. So similarly, they feel that their beliefs must express themselves by what one might term good works, certainly helping people in distress. Now, the Theravada monks would not, or followers of the Theravada tradition would not be unconcerned about this, but they would not see this as an essential part of their spiritual path. So you could loosely say that Theravada is a more self-centered approach to Buddhism than is the Mahayana tradition. Some would say it is less sentimental and it is less watered down with things that cannot be verified. Theravada teaching tends to say that you've really got to verify this. Do you sense that you are making progress, and tests that you can put in order to discover this? Whereas in Mahayana, there's more emphasis, I suppose, on the emotion in Mahayana Buddhism than there is in the Theravada tradition. So you can see that the two, while they share certain basic teachings of Buddha, are really quite a long way apart from each other. So that if anybody is to ask you what does Buddhism teach, you'd have to make it quite plain that there is this distinction, just as one would do if somebody said, what does Christianity teach? All right, well now, I want just to now talk about two of the expressions of Buddhism that occurred after it had left the native land in which Buddhism was born or was first expressed. It left there partly because of the Islamic invasion, the Mughals in the 11th and 12th centuries, because the Buddhists being on the whole pacifists, following the path of Ahimsa, non-violence, A-H-I-M-S-A, non-violence, were not so equipped to stand up to the Islamic invaders as were the Hindus, who, having their warriors as second only to the priests and teachers in their caste system, were more able to withstand the invasion. And also because, in some ways, Buddhism began to look a little bit like Hinduism in many respects, and the question arose as to whether there was the need for a second religion, also talking about karma, also talking about reincarnation or rebirth, also talking about Maya, and so on. So did it need two religions? Well, that's an issue that you may like to ponder on, but let's look at two of the expressions of Buddhism beyond India. And it all begins with the start of Buddhism in China, which began as a result of the sailing to China of one of the leaders of Buddhism, a man called Bodhidharma, who went to China in the 6th or 7th century of our era, that is to say, well over 1,000 years after Buddha had died. Now, Bodhidharma, again, let's go back to that, B-O-D-H-I, that's body, enlightened, same cognate word as Buddha. And Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, means teaching. So the name is simply means one who has enlightened teaching. So clearly this is a title rather than an actual name. He came to China and he eventually settled in North China and is famous as being the man who, when he arrived at a monastery in North China, sat in this monastery and faced a wall for 9 years. It's known as Men Peki Kunin, 9 years in front of a wall, and you will see paintings of him sitting facing a wall, sometimes facing the wall of a cliff. Now, what it appears is that in this time people gradually came up to find out why he was doing this. And he began to speak about Chan, C-H apostrophe A-N, which is a transcendental spiritual feeling, but which you will know better, I'm sure, as Zen, because that's the word it took over when it, or the word it became when it was transliterated in Japan. And I'm going to talk just for a bit about Zen Buddhism. It emphasizes, as, of course, does Hinduism and other Buddhism, it emphasizes that the aim of life is what they call dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A, or absorption. What it argues is that this moment of absorption, which is the moment of enlightenment, comes in a flash, that you don't gradually attain it. You might continue along the same kind of path, engaged in the same kind of activities for many years, and then suddenly enlightenment dawns. And this moment of enlightenment, and this is a key Zen word, is Satori, S-A-T-O-R-I. It comes from the word Saturo, to know. In that moment of enlightenment, you know it absolutely, without any doubt. It's a little bit like the description of enlightenment that in Hinduism Adi Shankara gave when he, if you've heard that lecture, a man sitting in a room who thinks that there is a poisonous snake at the other end of the room, and then suddenly, just a flash of illumination, he sees it's not a snake at all, it's a rope. And from that point onwards, he's never going to think it's a snake again. Just one split second is enough. And so it is this instantaneous expression of it which gives Zen its real central emphasis, which is really saying that our real nature is intuitive, not rational, intuitive, certainly not physical, and that in great flashes of intuition we understand. And they use all sorts of imagery to show how intuition works. They say that it is as if an archer hits his target without taking aim. And it's certainly the case, isn't it, that in many activities we have, whether it's playing a musical instrument or in a sport, or even playing a game of chess, as I've discovered, the moment you become conscious what you're doing and start to think what you're doing, you seem to lose the skill of doing it. And very often you begin to think what you're doing when somebody's standing over watching you. I know that I have been best at sport when I haven't felt that somebody's watching me to see how I'm playing. That I've been best at playing the piano when there hasn't been somebody staring at the music to see that I'm playing it correctly. That just leave me on my own. I will do far better when I forget about that this is me playing and simply become, as it were, absorbed in the music. Certainly the greatest exponents of any musical instrument, as of any sport, are those who are lost, as it were, lost their self-consciousness in the activity they're engaged in. Now, this is the essence of Zen, and what it's in its monasteries, and indeed as Zen has spread, because we have Zen Buddhism groups throughout the Western world, it is this awaiting Satori, enlightenment, that is the central feature of it. Now, that's the positive side. There are things that Zen says they see as a hindrance to this time of enlightenment. And here we come on to some very interesting teaching, I think. And for anybody who's interested in the mystical experience, the sense of absorption in the infinite, which is what Zen is talking about, might be interested in the lumber that they describe as weighing down anybody who is trying to walk along this path, to move along this path towards enlightenment. There are three in particular. The first of these is dependence on ritual. any public form of religion, any outward service where you're following the Book of Common Prayer, the Missal, the Prayer Book, or whatever, whatever. Now, we've seen that in Hinduism, they said that one of the three hindrances to finding moksha, or enlightenment, was the dharma, the teaching, or the ritual. But they talked about it as a hindrance, but not as a... to be watched, in other words, not to get the idea that because you've gone through the ritual, you are therefore necessarily making progress in the path to enlightenment. So in Hinduism, it stands as a warning not to be dependent on it, but go on and engage in it. Zen Buddhists, on the other hand, would see ritual not just as a hindrance, but as a positive disadvantage and positively a way of leading people astray. Because so far as the Zen masters who have followed Bodhidharma in that tradition, as far as they're concerned, anybody who takes part in liturgy is going to live really in a state of self-delusion. He will think that because he's been to the service, therefore he must have done some good for his soul, or must have done his spiritual destiny some, giving it a boost forward. The Zen might well have said, because they do like rather witty remarks, that the danger is that a person prays on his knees and on a Sunday and on his neighbours for the rest of the week. Well, perhaps that's putting it a bit in a Western humorous style, but certainly they would argue anybody who depends on ritual is putting his trust in that which is certain to lead him astray. So there is no ritual. There is long periods of meditation, wordless, soundless meditation, what they call shikantaza, meaning nothing but sitting. Whatever enlightenment you're going to get, the Sartori will strike you not through worship, not through ritual, not through liturgy, but through silent meditation. So that's the first one. The ritual, you see, lacks spontaneity. At the beginning of a service, those who are leading the service know exactly what is going to take place over the following hour or so. For that is counterproductive so far as Zen Buddhism is concerned. The second area that they point to as being harmful to anybody seeking Satori are the concept of sacred writings. The idea that we have in this book the truth, that this book is the word, and if it's not in the book, then we don't want it, and if it is in the book, no matter how strange it may seem, it must be true. Now, what Zen Buddhists would say is that the moment you say that of certain writings, and to a certain extent the Hindus said that about the Vedas, and other Buddhists have said it about the Dhammapada, the Tripitaka that I was talking about, that if you say that, then you're mistaking the real thing for the sort of vessel which conveys it. You're giving to the pipeline all the worth that really is only to be found in that which the pipeline is conveying. And that is how Zen Buddhists would see anybody who holds up, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, the Vedas, or the Dhammapada, hold them up aloft and say, here is the truth. They would say it is rather like a man standing with his friend and pointing up at the moon and says, what is that? And his friend says, that's your finger. And that is the kind of blindness that they see as happening when people look upon the writings, which reflect ideas from different people at different times, some of which may be valuable, some of them not so valuable. But anybody who says these writings are the ultimate truth is making that grievous error. And Zen would say,
beware. We're not saying you shouldn't read at all, but don't start thinking that because it's there, it must be true. You read and know that in the end, the enlightenment you're going to get is for you, and it must be an immediate, intuitive experience that doesn't come through the written word. And the third, and probably the most important aspect of Zen, and the one that anybody who's been to a Zen Buddhist meeting will know about, is their warning about intellectual debate. After all, if you're trying to pursue one's intuition, as I was saying earlier, the moment you start thinking about it, it seems you can't perform quite as well. And intellectual debate, they feel, is a very interesting activity, no doubt. And if you are intellectually minded, you probably enjoy engaging yourself in it. And you enjoy reading intellectual books, which, again, occupy that side of your personality, the rational faculty. But it will get you absolutely nowhere towards Satori or enlightenment, because that enlightenment comes through intuition, not through reason. Now, this is very hard for many in the West to take on board, because we do tend to be rather worshippers of reason. And many Western philosophers would say that our reason is our highest and most noble gift. Not so, say Zen Buddhists. They're not saying you should put your reason aside, you should live a life without reason, but they're saying it will not help, it will be a hindrance if you rely on your reason towards achieving Satori. And it is here that the typical Zen aid to meditation comes in. It is the koan, K-O-A-N, with which you may well be familiar. This is a question which, from the rational point of view, is meaningless. Most famous koan: what is the sound of one hand clapping? There are hundreds of others. One of them is, if I have nothing, what should I do? The answer is, throw it away. Or if you, these are all, I'm reading some koans now, you can buy books of koans. If you run away from the void, you can never be free of it. If you search for the void, you can never reach it. Now, a Zen monk in one of the two major schools, at any rate, of Zen, the Rinzai school, R-I-N-Z-A-I, may well be given one of these rationally meaningless koans to meditate on. The purpose of the koan being to indicate that it is not through intuition, but through, not through reason, but through intuition, that you're going to achieve some kind, the enlightenment. And therefore, you meditate on something which is, by the words it uses, by the concepts it introduces, irrational. It's to enable you to get beyond your rational faculties to the intuitive. There is one school, however, the Soto school, which doesn't even believe in using these koans. It simply says that you should have wordless meditation. Nothing to help you at all. It should be within yourself. As one Soto teacher said, your own heart, that is all you need. Well, the question is, can we define Zen as a religion? I kept talking about Zen Buddhism, but in a way, it's neither more Buddhist than anything else. It's neither Buddhist, nor Hindu, nor Christian, nor Jewish, nor any other religion. It is a universal concept, I think, that is coming out. And in fact, this has been, by one writer, this is how he describes Zen. It's not really a religion. It is the indefinable
incommunicable root, free from all names, all desires, all descriptions, all concepts, that can only be experienced by the individual for him or herself. So I would say it's not really bound to any religion at all, not even to Buddhism. It is a sort of primordial perfection, if you like, of the spiritual side of life. It's got many names and has had many names, but it's been experienced, I would suggest, by all the great saints and sages and founders of religion in all cultures and at all times. I would say that Jesus had discovered what Zen means, that Muhammad had discovered it, and that Zen, therefore, is the universal experience of the mystical side of religion. Now, just to bring this discussion of the wider side of Buddhism to a close, we shan't have time in this lecture to talk about Tibetan Buddhism. That is something that is so complex that it would need a whole lecture to itself. But we can look at Buddhism as it has developed mostly in China. And in fact, the school of Buddhism, which has more members probably than all other Buddhists put together, certainly the largest single branch, and it's called Pure Land Buddhism. And here we have, I suppose you could say that Zen Buddhism is taking Buddhism very far along the path of Theravada, being very strict, in other words, in its teaching as to how enlightenment is achieved. Pure Land Buddhism is much more open. It was founded by a man called Amitabha, A-M-I-T-A-B-H-A, Amitabha, which actually means boundless light. So again, we have a title more than a name. He was traditionally a king who became a monk after he had encountered Buddhist teaching. And he began to seek enlightenment and vowed that if he did find enlightenment, he would free his karmic merit, that is the merit he'd built up by building up good karma. The word for merit is punya, P-U-N-Y-A. He would free this to others. This is what he apparently said. And that by calling on his name, his merit would come to them. Now, what then happens when they achieve his merit, and why is it called Pure Land? What he taught was that there are Buddha realms or Buddha paradises which exist in and around us. They are spiritual and invisible, but they're real. And that it is open to any Buddhist who's following this particular path to enter into one of these Buddha realms or Buddha paradises. And having entered into this realm, which he believes he can do in this life, having entered into this Buddha realm, your ultimate entry into nirvana is assured. Now, obviously, the Theravada Buddhists would have been horrified by this. The idea that lots of people can enter into nirvana in this way would have not been along their way of thinking at all. The most important, the most famous of the Pure Lands is Sukhaviti, S-U-K-H-A-V-I-T-I, Sukhaviti, which means literally the blissful, and it's usually known as the Pure Land of the West. The Pure Land of the West. Now then, how do you, if you belong to the Pure Land Buddhist school, how do you enter into it? Well, there are three ways. The first is to repeat constantly and many times over, simply the name Amitabha. 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 To say that over and over again. And a Chinese Buddhist who belongs to this school will do precisely that every day. Secondly, you try to envisage Amitabha in his blissful Pure Land. You create an image of him in your mind. If you do this and do it conscientiously and constantly, then the third step is that you will see a vision of Amitabha. And when that happens, you know that you will be reborn in Sukhaviti, the Pure Land of the West. This is known as literally the easier way, in which the power of others comes your way, rather than following your own way. The words that they say over and over again are veneration to the Buddha Amitabha. And the veneration in Chinese is Namo O Mi To Fo. And I suppose you could say this, that inasmuch as repeating the same phrase or the same name or the same word over and over again does settle the mind, so that perhaps if you're going to proceed to bring out the intuitive side of your natures, this is one way of doing it. And I've attended Buddhist meetings, for example, not of the Pure Land school, but of the Nichiren school, in which the same phrase is chanted over and over and over again. And there are apparently people who work at the BBC, many film stars, who whenever they get a break, kneel down or sit down and chant the same phrase over and over again. It is found quite as a simple practical and physical fact to settle the mind and to calm people down. And as I know from a member of my family who has seen this happening in prisons in Australia, the prisoners are given times of chanting. And what they have found, this has been the case for some years now, and what they have found is that the incidence of violence in Australian prisons since this chanting the same phrase over and over again, has come in. The incidence of violence has gone down, and some might say that this might be a good thing in some of our schools to replace, I don't know, you have to think for yourself which subjects you would replace with Buddhist chanting. But this is obviously a very, very different kind of Buddhism from the Theravada tradition, the strict, rigorous tradition that is there, and different again from the Zen tradition with its emphasis on the intuition. Here we've got some very simple, and they are simple, simple steps which a simple person can take in order to assure himself or herself that they have achieved the final goal to which Buddha himself pointed. You may feel this is not for you, but there are others who might say, well, if they find it is helping them to make a bit of sense of this troubled life, then it is not for anybody who has seen perhaps a higher vision than that to be in any way condescending towards them. Then that may well be the case. It is not highly regarded, Pure Land Buddhism in China. In fact, Confucians in China are rather scathing about it. But then this is often the case that those who are among the learned and the intellectuals of society tend to look down on those who haven't achieved so much as they have in that particular area. I think we'd be wrong to make a judgment. What we can see is that Buddhism does manifest itself in a wide range of ways. But ultimately, I think I would want to say this about Buddhism. For my money, Buddhism is more a psychological way of coping with the changes and troubles of life than a religion. There are elements of it as a religion as it spread and modified itself in countries beyond those of where it originated. That is certainly the case. But if it is the case, and I think it is, that Theravada Buddhism and perhaps Zen Buddhism as a slight offshoot represent essential Buddhism, then the denial of an immortal soul and the denial, therefore, of life after death, and certainly the denial of any god, seems to me to make it very difficult to call it a religion, unless, and this is a big unless by religion you mean the ability to have some kind of mystic experience where you lose the sense of yourself as a self-conscious individual, with you conscious of things here and that which you're conscious of out there. If that is religion, and there is a strong case, I think, could be made to say that at least that is the essential feature of religion, the mystical experience, then indeed Buddhism can be counted among the world's religions. But I think supremely, Buddhism represents one of the most successful ways yet given to us as human beings to cope with the troubles and anxieties of life which all of us have to face. For that, I think the world must be grateful.